Romans chapter 10, verses 9 to 17. This is God's word. If you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. For with the heart one believes and is justified, and with the mouth one confesses and is saved. For the scripture says, everyone who believes in him will not be put to shame. For there is no distinction between Jew and Greek, for the same Lord is Lord of all, bestowing his riches on all who call on him. For everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. How then will they call on him in whom they have not believed? And how are they to believe in him of whom they have never heard? And how are they to hear without someone preaching? And how are they to preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the good news. But they have not all obeyed the gospel. For Isaiah says, Lord, who has believed what he has heard from us? So faith comes from hearing, and hearing through the word of Christ. Isaiah chapter 9, verses 2 to 7. Hear the word of the Lord. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them has light shined. You have multiplied the nation, you have increased its joy. They rejoice before you as with joy at the harvest, as they are glad when they divide the spoil. For the yoke of his burden and the staff for his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor, you have broken as on the day of Midian. For every boot of the tramping warrior in battle tumult and every garment rolled in blood will be burned as fuel for the fire. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace there will be no end, on the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and with righteousness, from this time forth and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. And please do keep your Bibles open, as that would be a great help to me as we preach through these verses. Now, something very dramatic happened to me this Thursday. Let me tell you about it. It's moderately interesting. Cornhill had finished for the day and we were tidying up afterwards. Now, you might be thinking, oh, so putting away all those Bibles and those hardcore theology books, but no, actually, it was more like tidying away all the tea and coffee pots and cups we had used all day. And so, in order to participate, I grabbed the milk to take it down to the kitchen and the fridge, as you do. Now, the kitchen in this church, it's actually downstairs, underground level a little bit, so it's dark. And I entered the corridor to go to the kitchen, and it was dark. And I couldn't find the light switch, and I couldn't turn it on because my hands were full of milk cartons. So I decided, well, I'll just power on through. I can barely see a thing, but sure, no bother to me. So I'm sure you're all really buying into this story right now and feeling the tension. Anyway, on I go down this dark corridor, and disaster strikes. I forgot that there was a step just before you enter the kitchen, and I tripped over it. And the milk almost went flying everywhere. Now, you're probably thinking, that's an incredibly boring story, that's not dramatic at all, but you have to put this in its context. We drank an awful lot of tea and coffee throughout the day at Cornhill, and I didn't want to be responsible for the great caffeine drought of the next day, so actually this was a very dramatic experience. Now, there is a point to that story, and the point is simply this. Whether we realize it or not, when you're living in the dark, you really need a light. If you're in darkness without any light to help you, then it's a recipe for disaster. We bundle about and we trip over and we hurt ourselves. And Christmas time is all about light. People in this town, they tend to complain about how early the council puts up the Christmas lights. I don't even know what the date was this year, probably mid-September. Pretty soon it's going to be handier for us just to leave the lights on up, like all year round. Or maybe you look across the road and Mr. Christmas Cheer over there has his tree up and the house lights flashing away already. But even though we complain, the truth is that at Christmas time we need the light. In fact, I'll be honest here, as much of a cynic as I am, I really like the Christmas lights going up as soon as possible. Because winter time can be seriously dark and dreary. We barely get any hours of proper daylight, so it can be depressing. So Christmas is great because it adds so much needed light and cheeriness to a pretty miserable time of the year. So just imagine how grim winter would be without Christmas. Christmas lights up the darkness. But of course, we know this morning that there's more to all this than literal physical darkness. We live in a world where actually we are surrounded by some sort of spiritual darkness. We look around us, we switch on the news, and it's as if the world is just covered by some sort of dense fog, and we can see it, and we know that the world just isn't as it should be. People don't treat each other as they should do. There's so much good and potential out there, but it just doesn't seem to be able to pierce through the dark. And we live in a world of some sort of spiritual darkness. Now, at the time of Isaiah's writing here, Israel too was in the middle of a time of real darkness, national and spiritual darkness. The nation of Israel was a total shambles at this point, really. Since Solomon had died, it had all gone to pot. There was north and there was south Israel. It had been split in half, and the north and the south could never really bring themselves to get along with each other. Northern Israel in particular was a real disaster because right from the outset it was constantly worshipping idols and happily ignoring God. So in response to this, God is sending Assyria across from the east to punish his people in North Israel. Now, in response to that, North Israel doesn't go, okay, fair enough. No, they're going to fight back. And so North Israel, they call down south and they say to South Israel, well, you better team up with us against this Assyrians or we're going to come and get you. Now, I don't know if you ever played the board game Risk, but it's a lot like that. Everyone's just waiting to attack everyone else and betray each other. So it's a real state of political and national darkness here. It's a pretty hopeless situation. But it gets worse because the king in the south, he's called Ahaz, and he's been warned by God and Isaiah here, stay neutral, don't take sides. This is God's doing, just you stay out of it. But he's decided that he doesn't trust God's protection, and Ahaz has happily made an alliance with Assyria. So it's a total mess. It's national despair and darkness. Everyone's out to get everyone else. And this all comes from a deeper state of spiritual darkness within the nation of Israel that the north and south had been in. As I already said, the north was hopeless, but the south wasn't exactly a shining example of godliness either. As I said, God had promised the south that he would protect them as long as they stayed neutral. But King Ahaz, he didn't trust God at all, nor did the people. So in the south of Israel, the Jews, they just aren't following the law anymore. They have no interest in the Torah or anything like that. And they had completely forgotten all the great things that God had done for them in their own history. So instead of trusting God's advice, the common people were actually, this is quite strange, but they were getting really into talking to mediums and necromancers. They liked talking to the dead. They would rather take the advice of the dead than they would of the living God. So how dodgy does that sound? So basically, Israel is in total darkness in Isaiah's day. It's just about almost a lost cause. And we too recognize that we're surrounded in this darkness also. A world that just isn't how it should be. And sometimes we can almost feel this haziness and this fogginess inside of us all, this darkness. So where's the hope? Where can we find the light that we need? And that question leads us to our first point this morning, because actually, from this prophecy in Isaiah, we can see that God provides light to the people in darkness. Verses 2 and 3, God is the one who can and does step into the mess. So Israel's in darkness, and it's a mess. The northern kingdom is a goner, and Isaiah, or God, is pleading with Ahaz and the south to wise up and to listen, to get back to the Torah, see for themselves that God has always been trustworthy. But no, The people have lost faith in God. They have no trust in him whatsoever. They've lost faith. And this all takes place in chapter 8. Worse than that, though, it's not just that they've forgotten God. It's not just that they kind of believe in God, but they basically live like atheists. No, Israel has come to hate God. Things are going badly for them. And rather than realize that actually it's their own fault, they blame God. They hate him more and more, and they curse him for everything that goes wrong. So that's how bad it's gotten in Israel. They're so blind, they're so lost in the dark, that they hate God, the God who has always gone out of his way to look after them. Now, I'm sure you've realized this or thinking it yourself, but our world isn't so different to Israel back then. People nowadays also hate God. There's no big secret there. But it's not just that people don't believe in God. They really hate him, and they blame him for all that goes wrong. So it's always, God, why did you let my house get flooded? Whenever God could equally say back to sinful people, well, why were you stupid enough to buy a house that's situated on a floodplain? But everything goes wrong is always God's fault. And people are blind to the actual sin and the actual darkness within themselves. That is the real cause. But it's worth reminding ourselves here that Israel is God's chosen people. So actually, Isaiah's not talking to unbelievers here who lack faith in God and blame him. Isaiah is essentially speaking to the church. Isaiah is speaking to God's people who are faithless and who blame God. So Christians too, we're really quick to turn on God when it all goes south for us. And we commit and we allow all sorts of little and big sins among us in church. And then we wonder why God won't send revival or why the church isn't growing. So we have here a bit of a rubbish situation. And quite frankly, God really has every right to abandon his people. I mean, they tend just to be a little bit embarrassing and a lot ungrateful. And we just love living in the dark sometimes. But God does not abandon a world in darkness. In fact, it's the opposite. God is merciful and gracious. And in verses 2 and 3, he promises light to these rebellious, dark people. In verse 2, God declares his intent. Light will shine through the darkness. And he puts this in the past tense, have seen a great light. And he does this because it's so certain to happen in the future that it might as well have already happened in the past. And actually, God uses that a lot in the Bible, to speak in the past tense, because it might as well have already happened. It's so sure. Those walking in the darkness, they will see a great light. And I kind of thought, it's the way he uses the word walking here. It's like the people in darkness, they're just strolling about. They don't realize how bad a place they are in. Or if they do, they don't care. And it's a deep darkness. It's a horrible place to be in. And yet the people, they're just walking and dandering about. It's very casual. It's a sense of just being really nonchalant. Now, I don't know about you, but if I'm ever sitting in the house on my own and the lights go off and I hear a door getting thumped in, I don't act casual and nonchalant. It's somewhere dangerous, and I think when we know we're somewhere dangerous, then the first thing we do is run. But Israel isn't getting the whole weight of the situation here at all. But still, God promises that this nation, which is so daft, that's such a letdown, he'll multiply it. And that's quite an outstanding promise to make, isn't it? He'll make bigger and more prosperous a nation that had proven itself to be pretty useless. A nation that's just being constantly squeezed by its enemies all the time. Now, what he's saying there is that the faithful remnant who don't hate God, who still trust in the God of their fathers, he will restore them and make them fruitful despite all the darkness of the foreign nations and even within their own fellow Jews. This remnant that remains faithful to God, they will see the light. And God will increase the nation's joy. A joy so fulfilling and so great that it's as if they've just had the most bumper harvest ever, or it's as if they've just won the toughest battle and now they get to spend the money and the spoils of their enemies. So we all know what it's like when we enjoy a good feed, or when we get one up on that person in work who seems to spend their weekends thinking of ways to annoy us. It's a pretty satisfying feeling, isn't it? And God's joy, God's promise of joy and satisfaction here, that goes way beyond that even more. So what a promise. Light in the darkness for a people who seem to prefer darkness. And restoration and joy to people who have just shunned God. So we can see God's character. He's a God who provides hope in a world who hates him, hope in a world that has none in and of itself. So he's patient and merciful, and he remembers his remnant in dark times and still promises that they will grow and be fruitful. So God is so faithful and true to his word, even to a church or a people that have no faith in him. And we can so easily lose faith, especially in the church, and we look at the people of God that we're a part of and we think, well, what a bunch of losers, what a fairly sorry lot we can be. But God does not give up on his people. And by implication of that, if God doesn't give up on the church, then neither should we ever be tempted to give up on church. Or maybe on a personal note, we've just lost faith and we've embraced the darkness and we've just stopped praying. We're practically atheists. But God can still shine light into our darkness if we regain our trust in him. I often think that's the difference between God and Santa. Santa only comes to those whenever they've been good. Thankfully, though, God comes to his children even though they've been bad. So we live in darkness, but God still chooses to shine a light into it. In our second point, we see what that light brings. God's light brings peace on earth, verses 4 and 5. Israel could really do with a moment's peace here. They're being battered by their enemies. They can't even get along with each other, north and south. They're just having the life squeezed out of them and their own sin. Now, Israel, they're aware of the problem in a sense. They know it's not a great situation they're in. And they can see Assyria coming towards them, and they know we really need some peace here. We need some sort of security. They aren't totally deluded by sin. But the problem is that when they realize that they need peace and security, they still don't turn back to God. They try and sort it out themselves. And so Ahaz, as we heard, makes a deal with Assyria to betray the north, when in actual fact, Assyria has every intention of getting its fingers on the whole of the nation, north and south. They're a fairly greedy bunch. You know, it's really bad of Ahaz to fall into this trap of being faithless too. I mean, if you think about it, Ahaz is a king of David. He's in the line of David. And David, as we know, he always knew that God was his source of security. We just need to look at the Psalms that David wrote. But Ahaz, his descendant, the Davidic king Ahaz, he's just a million miles away from that. And that really is a surprising thing. It's a bit like if David Beckham's sons turned out to be just completely rubbish at football. That's just not what you expect from that family name. So the nation wants peace, but it wants it on its own terms. It doesn't want to bring God into it all. And our world is the same. At the end of the day, that's all we want, safety and security. But no one can actually ever seem to find it. No one ever has a moment's peace. We all know that even though this world strives for peace and safety, we can't find it, even at Christmas time. There's a Christmas song that goes, "They said there'd be snow at Christmas. They said there would be peace on earth." And it's a song of feeling let down at Christmas time. Because Christmas can be so poignant, because there's all these promises of peace and this wonderful, peace attached to it. And yet, truthfully, sometimes Christmas is really not all it's cracked up to be. And what peace and goodwill there actually is among people can very quickly fade away. Very, very quickly. I mean, Band-Aid and Bob Geldof, they've tried to feed the world four times now, and it's still not getting any better. We can never have this peace on our own strength, and neither could Israel. Not while God is left out. Because God is the one whose light brings that peace. God breaks the burdens on his people. He removes the oppressors. In verse 4, just like on the day of Midian, when Gideon and his tiny, tiny army miraculously beat their enemies. I mean, that victory was down to God. It wasn't down to Gideon. Gideon was not a particularly special person at all. And God mentions Midian and Gideon here because surely the Israelites will remember how great that victory was, and they'll know that it was down to God's strength. It should be so obvious to Israel here when God mentions Midian. God has always looked after us. God has always brought peace. So let's not do it ourselves. Obviously, that's not what they're thinking. And verse 5, too, is a great promise to the people that the warriors' boot that trample on their promised land and the garments they have that are stained with blood, these things will be gone, just tossed into the fire. They won't be coming back. Happy Christmas. The war is over. So it's a bit like that Sainsbury's ad at Christmas that I actually don't like very much, but World War I in the trenches. That's what happens when God intervenes. When light comes into the darkness, there is real and lasting peace. So by implication, what we need to do is realize that only God has the power to fix our world, not Bob Geldof. And when we look at our own lives and we see that things aren't overly happy, we're seeing things in our lives that we're not particularly proud of, we need to accept that God is the one who can bring peace there when the light comes. And Christians especially need to be reminded of this. Only God can bring peace. Only God saves the world. So we need to remember to pray. If God is the one who says he will bring peace, then we, more than anything else, need to pray that he will do it. To remind him of the promises that he made in Isaiah. Pray. Now, all these promises sound pretty good. If we're wise enough to see the darkness that's in and around us, then the promise of light and peace, that's something that we would really, really like. I mean, if you have the problem of hunger and someone hands you a token for a free meal at Tully Glass, then you know you're going to snap that up. You want the solution to your problem. And that leads us to our third point, which is this. Only through God's Son and King can we have this light. Verses 6 and 7. The light that solves everything, it comes with the Messiah, Christ. So this light and peace that God promises, it's not just an airy-fairy thing that floats about in the world that we can tap into like some sort of force and we just go, it actually comes objectively. It's an event. It comes with the birth of a child, a son that is given to the people. The fact that verse 6 says that it's given is pretty important when you really think about it. This child is a gift of God, a gift from heaven, a son offered freely to the people. So it's clearly someone who's going to be very special. But this gifted son, he's also going to be a king, a mighty ruler. The government will be set upon his shoulder, and he can bear that burden. He has the strength to carry the weight of the crown. And the names and titles given here in verse 6, they're so impressive and they're so important. A wonderful counselor, a king who can lead his people with great wisdom and with important teachings. He's called Mighty God, a strong king, mighty, one that's more than the average human being. An everlasting father, a king that acts like a father, who can look after his children, and one that will never leave, one that will never go away. And a prince of peace, a king who can truly bring peace and safety to his people. So this son promise sounds absolutely amazing. Much better than the king that Israel had at the time. Ahaz was a total failure. He hadn't led with wisdom. Ahaz wasn't strong. He cowered before his enemies. And he didn't bring any peace to the people either. He just builds up the trouble for them. And then you move into verse 7 and we learn even more about this gifted son king. His kingdom will never end. And it will be built upon the throne of David, of the line of David, which is currently at this time acting pretty poorly. So this is the Messiah we're talking about here. This is the one who will rule with kingly attributes. He'll rule with justice and righteousness, the sort of attributes that God demands of a king over his people. So this is fantastic news for Israel. Ahaz has ruined them. Mind you, it's not as if the people are innocent in it all, but still, the king sets the example to follow, and Ahaz is rubbish. But this promised king in verses 6 and 7, he sounds like the real deal. He's a true king, a king who can really bring in all the promises of verses 2 to 5. Now, actually, what Isaiah is partly talking about here is Ahaz's son, Hezekiah. Good King Hezekiah, he led the people well. He was a very godly king. But this can't just be King Hezekiah. I mean, Hezekiah, he was good, but he's not that good. I mean, the people are expecting a brand new Ferrari here, and Hezekiah is a bit like your first car. It does the job, but it's still full of problems and faults. And there's no human king that can be an everlasting father. This prophecy just cannot be referring to Ahaz's son, Hezekiah. That's not it. This is all about Christ and his birth at Christmas. The child who was born 2,000 years ago in Bethlehem, he was and is the one who truly fulfills the conditions of verses 6 and 7. Christ is the light of God, the one who can clear away and does clear away all the darkness of sin. Christ is the one who brings verses 2 to 5 to his people. Christ promises many benefits and blessings to his people, and he brings that true peace and joy. But it's important to remember that it's only to his own people. Christ's promises, his benefits, this peace and joy, it's exclusive. It's only to those who are Christ's subjects. We all want the light. No one wants to live in darkness, and so many seek it in their own way. But true light and true life is brought only to those who believe in Christ, who trust him as their king. No one else can bring the light, only Christ, for his people. So that fact should really encourage the faith of God's people. Today, we can fade in faith as Israel did. But at Christmas, we have a special privilege of being able to look back to each 25th of December, and we have our faith restored because we can see that God kept his promise. Our king was born. And verse 7 finishes off this portion of the prophecy when it says that the zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this, and he did. And that's a great encouragement to people because we can trust a God who does not let us down. However, for the unbeliever, for you this morning, the message of Christmas is and always will be quite simple. We have a problem. Only God can fix it. We live in darkness, and Christ is the only light we can have, and he is the one that we need. Christ is the true king we need, and he is indeed one powerful king.